Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa, and today I'm joined by Heather, Nicola, Stephanie and Linda.
Hello!
Hi! Hi.
Today I really want to talk about the young female poets who are taking the literary world by storm. We've been lucky enough to catch one. We'll be talking to performance poet Amy Lee Tempest later in the show. Nicola will be sharing her work in progress and getting some feedback. Heather and John Lomas Bullivant will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. And Stephanie will be sharing a word of the week. But first, Linda will ask us to...
name the novel!
I think probably Teresa's going to get this on the first clue, and if she does, I'm just going to slap her.
I'm moving away, moving out of arm's reach.
Okay. Written by a Brazilian author, published in 1988. This novel was written in only 2 weeks because the author said it was already written in his soul.
Wow.
I know, I can't imagine.
Can't be any good.
It was
an allegorical novel. It became a widely translated international bestseller and was published in English in 1993.
No
Brazilian
idea.
Author.
Yeah.
No
Male
idea.
Brazilian author.
Male
yeah. Brazilian author.
Mm.
2 weeks.
Who writes very quickly. Okay, this author should be an inspiration to us all when it comes to believing in your work. It was first released by a little-known Brazilian publishing house. It sold, but not enough to satisfy the publisher, who after a year decided to give back the rights to the author. So upset by this, he and his wife left Rio de Janeiro and spent 40 days in the Mojave Desert in an effort to heal. After that, the author was so convinced it was a great book that he started knocking on doors. By 2009, 10 years ago, the book had sold 35 million copies.
Still no idea. Entirely. So he was selling them door to door, and then
I don't know. It said he was knocking
over.
On doors. Yeah. So.
Or perhaps
publishing
doors.
I took that to mean publishers or agents, but
it's a way to sell your book, though, isn't it? Go door to door.
Yeah,
one copy a house.
Number three. Last clue. The theme of the book is about finding one's destiny. It follows the journey of an Andalusian shepherd boy named Santiago. The advice given Santiago that when you really want something to happen, the whole universe will conspire so that your wish comes true, is the core of the novel's philosophy and the motif that plays throughout it.
It sounds right up my street, doesn't it?
I think it's not because I don't want a slap, but I have no idea.
I think it might be The Alchemist.
Yes, it is.
I can't remember who wrote it.
Paulo Coelho.
That's...
Yes. Oh, listen to her. You got it. And you're not going to get a slap because...
I'm thinking that's...
Because you're not me.
Do you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking that's a non-fiction book. I think of that as a non-fiction book.
Oh, you do?
Isn't that interesting?
No,
I read it as well.
Yes. Because it's such a helpful book. It's such a wonderful book.
I thought it was Portugal.
He lived in Portugal for a while. But yeah.
Completely distracted by the South American connection there as well.
Really?
That's really...
Who
was it again?
Paulo Coelho.
Coelho. C-O-E-L-H-O.
The Alchemist. Everybody remembers it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
It's a thin book.
I didn't get it at all. I read it twice, actually, trying to get the meaning in it, and I just didn't...
Yeah.
Grasp it at all.
Okay.
I know how famous
it's
it is.
It's about finding your destiny.
Yeah.
First published in 1988.
Yeah.
Originally written in Portuguese.
Yes, because that's the language they speak in Brazil.
Oh, right.
How interesting.
Okay. I want to tell you one thing that I found really, really interesting and funny. Hannah Poole, who interviewed him for The Guardian, asked, "Do the critics hurt you?" And he answered, "No, writers are lampposts and critics are dogs." Ask lampposts what they think about dogs. Does the dog hurt the lampposts? Oh, and I want to give credit because some of these clues were compiled with help from The Guardian and also an article by Mark Flanagan. I love the book.
You loved it?
The book of The Alchemist, yes. I read it years ago, I think. Yeah,
it's a long time since I've read it. I might go back and read that again. Oh, no. That's one of those books that bears a second look, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, lots of people in my world talk about it as a real, you know,
real helpful
biblical
book.
Kind of tome.
And I'm just so impressed that he was that convinced it was a good book. He knew
I never knew that.
And just went around knocking on doors. But that's after 40 days in the desert. Wasn't there somebody else?
Miracles,
I think it also sounds a bit like myth-making, doesn't it? The 40 days in the desert. Yes. Yeah. He's setting himself up for that analogy. Really.
Well, what we did was went into the, you know, where they go into the caves and take that special thing that everyone
Or he stayed in a five-star hotel in Las Vegas. Come on.
Who knows? But it's a wonderful book.
Wonderful book and a great story about how it came to be.
Yeah. Very interesting, interesting. Okay, so now we're going to hear from Nicola and Brianne.
Yeah, well, I started out because I had this idea that, as I've said, I think, on one of the podcast episodes, that she didn't seem perturbed enough by what had happened to her. Mm-hmm. So I started out trying to write a scene where she was, railing against everything that happened to her. And it went in completely a different direction, and I just went with it for the sake of having something to read to you today. Brianne lay back on her bed when Rex had gone, feeling completely dazed. She really didn't understand what was happening, and the weird thing was she didn't seem to care. Everything that had happened since she decided back in her little cottage that she had simply had enough had been so surreal, her brain didn't feel like it had caught up at all. She felt tired but overstimulated, cynical but hopeful, and as if everything was just a dream. Closing her eyes, she concentrated on her breathing as she'd been taught in the otherwise 100% useless grief counselling sessions. In and out, slow it down, in and out. She was instantly transported back to the room in the community centre where she had watched disbelievingly as five or six very elderly people had jockeyed for position to talk in turn about their late departed loved one and how it had affected them. Sipping the scalding instant coffee that she'd volunteered to make just to keep busy, she listened to an ancient old lady talking about her Reg, as if he'd departed just yesterday, while watching another old lady unwrap the cling film from about 10 naked Bourbon biscuits, painfully slowly, before putting them on a side plate in the middle of the table. Brianne had hung back from the round table grief celebration, wondering how she would ever be able to make these nice, well-meaning people understand her last year of hell, or if she should even try. "Have a Bourbon, dear," said the crone with the cling film, which she was now carefully folding in ever smaller squares. No one else had touched the biscuits, in spite of the crone's urging, so Brianne was hesitant to look greedy in front of the others, being the new girl and all. An old man was talking about nursing his wife through her last couple of years of cancer now, everyone nodding and murmuring in sympathy at the main points, giving him a chance to dab his eyes and blow his nose. They had obviously heard the tale many times before. Brianne estimated that she was a good 20 to 30 years younger than anyone else in the room, apart from John the counsellor, who was about the same amount of years younger than her. His beard featured beads woven into the longer strands near the bottom and cradled crumbs from his lunch, perhaps a Cornish pasty to match the look of his shoes. The room was dim, due both to the overcast day and the profusion of houseplants in pots on shelves around the windows. The room was obviously used for a great variety of activities. "I haven't seen this many spider plants since the 70s, she thought. "What am I doing here? This isn't going to help." But her choices were now limited, having given up on the half-hearted telephone counselling, which was the only other grief therapy on offer that she didn't have to pay for. She'd only just been offered this group counselling session after crying on the doctor for well over her allotted 10 minutes appointment time. "And what about you, Brianne? Tell us about your loss." She heard John speak just as she'd reached for a bourbon and bitten half of it off, anticipating a chocolate buzz, realising just too late that the 10 bourbons were obviously brought to every meeting and then carefully wrapped in the cling film and taken home again. Brianne desperately tried to lever the super soft biscuit off the roof of her mouth with her tongue while reaching desperately for her cold Nescafe to wash it down.
Oh, there's some lovely wry humour in there.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you can tell from our reaction, the humour just works, and it feels very well crafted because of the way it ends with the biscuits.
The biscuits
and very
are real.
Authentic.
I was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the... How did she know they were brought to every meeting and people didn't eat them?
Because they were soft. It was soft when it went in her mouth.
She realised.
It was stale.
Oh.
It was and cleaved to the roof of her mouth.
Oh.
A bourbon biscuit is...
crisp.
Is crisp.
Oh, it
has
is.
It's a chocolate...
Like an Oreo.
like a chocolate... it's rectangular and it's chocolate or brown. It's supposed to be chocolate. And in the middle is a chocolate cream filling. And the outer casing is crisp, so when you bite it, now if you bit into a bourbon and it was soft, you would know it was really stale.
You know instantly why.
But the thing is, you probably have to be a Brit to know about bourbon biscuits, because they are very British, like custard creams.
Yeah. Thank you for the explanation, because I didn't know.
It also makes you realise that, you know, as a district nurse, you only accept biscuits once, and you learn.
Dear, oh dear.
One of the things I like so much was the thing about, haven't seen this many spider plants since the
70s. It was a very surreal experience.
Yeah. It's a true experience, actually. Yeah. And I think you can tell because it was surreal.
And I love the way she folds up the cling film.
Yeah.
I thought that was very well observed. And I thought, I put no single-use plastic for this parsimonious lady.
Yeah.
So good on her.
No, it was great.
I only went once.
No. There's a couple of places I think you've used words that aren't needed, and I've marked them all on the text here. So, for example, Brienne lay back on her bed when Rex had gone, feeling completely dazed. You don't need to tell us it's feeling. So you could just say feeling.
It's a bit ambiguous
lay
about
back
what
on
you've
her
been
bed
doing there as
when
well.
When Rex had gone, completely dazed. She really didn't understand. You could just say she didn't understand. And the weird thing was she didn't seem to care. The weird thing was she didn't care. I think if you take those unnecessary words
out. I thought seem felt wrong because she knows whether she cares or not. Yeah.
And then simply, when you said just bemused, and there's a very long sentence, sipping the scalding instant coffee and listening to the ancient old lady. You don't ancient and old. One of them is redundant. Yeah, I'd say ancient's a much better.
Well, I thought that was deliberate, but I thought it wasn't the effect necessarily having the effect you wanted. But I didn't know if it was deliberate or not. I thought it might be the ancient old, you know, for emphasis.
Mm.
But I said, you know, perhaps replace one of the words with something else like mouldering or crumbly or a bit rather than
stale.
Cause you're using
like the biscuits
because you're using old lady quite a bit
Well, they are old ladies. I've been there.
Well, we've got an old man later on, haven't we?
I must confess, you know, I'm not feeling very inspired by the whole Brienne thing anymore.
This is brilliant.
You've got some comic timing.
Yes, exactly. It's the timing. It's the structure. Works really well for the comedy.
Yeah.
And I know you don't want lots of little nitpicky comments. So, you know, I'm happy to, you know, I'll give you my comments, but I'm happy to leave it at that. But no, it's great. I think there are things, little things that could be improved. And I think when you were reading, you probably realised some of the sentences were a bit too long to read.
And convoluted.
A bit like we were saying last week for audio books, it's a great way to find out that your sentences are not.
But this is a wonderful piece. I laughed and laughed. And one of the things that I loved was, here we are with all of these older people in a room talking about the grief of losing their loved ones, and the counsellor has beads in his beard.
That's typical of English counsellors.
But I love that he obviously was of a whole different generation and mindset than these people.
Yeah. No, but that cradled crumbs from his lunch, perhaps a Cornish pasty to match the look of his shoes.
You can see those shoes.
You can see the shoes, the Cornish pasty shoes. That's why I laughed.
That's hilarious. Yes,
brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, I was trying to sort of convey this whole surreal experience that Brienne's having, being transported into a different world thing. And this scene just took off. Mm-hmm.
And the other one I liked was the grief celebration, the round table grief celebration. celebration. Because the juxtaposition of the word grief and the word celebration, because it is almost like people are wallowing in it. I've got my grief counselling today. Goody, goody.
It's their morning.
And the highlight of their week.
But also, I think it brings out that side of Brianne, which I know that you want to convey. It's that a bit self-absorbed and a little bit selfish. Like they don't know what it's like because they're old. It's okay.
Yeah,
it's natural for them to lose somebody, and it's not fair.
She feels apart all the time.
So I think that comes through, you know, quite subtly. So I think it's very, very good.
Well, Nicola,
who knows where it'll go? But
yeah,
I loved it. I wish you would write more comedy because you're so good at it.
Maybe you should write a comedy novel.
Yeah.
But I think with the more surreal scenes, the more out there sort of science fiction scenes, it's more difficult because with a scene like this, we recognise a lot in it and that's where the humour comes. And when you're in a different environment, and of course some authors do it very successfully, like Terry Pratchett, but it's harder, I think, in a fantasy scenario.
I think Nicola's up to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Brilliant. Well done. Thanks, Nicola. Stephanie, over to you.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm going to have another moan. Do you remember way, way back at the very beginning of doing these podcasts, I talked about the word literally, how people claim to literally jump out of their skin or I literally died, which clearly is not proper. And because everybody misuses the word, it's now become an intensifier rather than, you know, it is now accepted. So newspapers talk about it being literally the end of the world, stuff like that. Well, there's another word for which the same thing has happened, and that word is decimate. So just looking through newspapers, you've got things like the sporting calendar has been decimated by bad weather. Only 2 of 27 matches were played.
Yeah.
Or there was an article in British newspapers about whole areas around Heathrow Airport being decimated because they were going to be demolished to make way for an airport. And actually, decimate does not mean to completely destroy something. Mm-hmm. Decimate means to reduce something by a tenth.
Oh, a tenth. Because the deca.
Well, exactly, deca. Decimate.
Yeah.
The word obliterate would be a better choice than decimate in those cases. Decimate comes from the root deci, which can be found, you know, decimal and so on. And it comes from back in the Roman times when, to punish ill discipline, 1 in 10 prisoners or 1 in 10 soldiers would be executed as an example to the others. And that's what to decimate was. It was to reduce by a tenth. And it was normally an unpleasant thing.
Pretty horrific.
Yeah. But if you eat 10 out of 100 cookies, you'll have decimated the cookie batch.
Only 10?
So here's another word that I frequently hear people misusing, and I want to go, no, it wasn't decimated, it was obliterated, or it was, you know, largely got rid of. So anyway, that's just mine. I think what's happening now is it's becoming accepted that to decimate is to obliterate.
Yes, in the way that literally has come to mean figuratively.
Yeah, exactly. But it annoys me.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get that off my chest, share it with you, because I know that you'll have sympathy.
Well done. I've learned something today.
But language evolves.
Do you feel better now?
Not much.
Not much, no.
Okay, so what on earth is going on in the world of poetry? It seems that poets, many of them young women, are selling thousands of books and actually making money. Yes.
Wow.
Poets making money.
So before they're dead.
Yeah, before they're even dead. Before they're even dead white males. Or even at all. So a few months ago, I came across a couple of articles talking about this phenomenon, and I wanted to explore it with you. One appeared on a website, stylist.co.uk. I will share the link, so don't worry about making a note of it. And the other one was from The Guardian newspaper in January. So in the article on Stylist, author and poet Rosalind Janner shines a light on some of the most exciting voices to add to your reading list. And she says, poetry is thriving. Spend any amount of time browsing the Poetry Foundation website and you'll be immersed in a whole galaxy of thrilling contemporary work. Head to any bookshop and you'll find that the poetry section is bustling with treasures. We're buying more poetry than ever before. And in recently released figures from Nielsen Bookscan, sales of poetry in the UK increased by 12% last year.
In a year.
Wow. With teenage girls and young women making up the majority of the consumers.
Wow.
Which is fascinating, isn't it? Some of this is down to Instagram. She said the effects of Instagram can't be ignored. Now, again, for me, Instagram, I have this idea, it's just somewhere where you share photos, but there's obviously a lot more going on Instagram. Mm-hmm. The poet Rupi Kaur is cited as one of the most successful Instagram poets. And Twitter as well has amplified the power of a single poem's impact. So it's happening on these social media, and that's maybe where I haven't been so aware of it. It's absolutely fascinating what's going on. In the Guardian article, Keats is Dead, How Young Women Are Changing the Rules of Poetry, the author says, a new generation of female writers has attracted millions of online followers and an increasingly diverse audience. Charlie Cox, the poet, explains why she thinks her poetry is so popular with young women. It's a really difficult age to articulate how you're feeling, she says. We're all so stressed out. We're so confused, so lonely. Poetry is an incredible form of solace. If you encounter something in a poem that you feel you're feeling, it's a freeing, lovely experience. And she also began publishing first on Instagram. And she says a lot of poets who are coming from online platforms are women or people of colour. And I think that this has unsettled the very traditional, predominantly white, older male community who have spent so long feeling that poetry is an incredibly exclusive academic club. Well, it's not anymore. It's being blown open. So young women aged 13 to 24 are now the biggest consumers of poetry in the UK, a market that's grown by 48% over the past 5 years in this article.
Wow.
And going back to Rupi Kaur, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, for example, she made, wait for this, nearly £1 million from poetry sales last year.
Whoa.
Yeah. With themes including menstrual taboos, sexual violence and women's empowerment. Three other women, Pam Ayres, Helen Dunmore and Carol Ann Duffy, all netted sales into six figures, something almost unheard of.
Is that the Pam Ayres?
Yes, the Pam Ayres,
And the Carol Ann Duffy.
And the article cites the ease with which poetry can be published online, read on mobile phones, shared on social media, as one reason why it's become really popular with teenagers and millennials, and with young poets attracting millions and millions of followers. Mm-hmm. And this is something that comes out in our interview with Amy, which we'll hear a little later. Mm-hmm. So, Linda, you've been looking at one of these rising stars.
But I think as you're reading that, the reason, I believe, the reason that these young people are really attracted to poetry now is because these young female writers are speaking truth. They're not holding back. They're not describing green pastures. They're talking about life and its joys and brutalities. But it's just, well, I bought a book by Esther. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Her name is Y-S-E-R. And the last hyphenated, Daily Ward. Esther Daily Ward. Called Bone, and she just knocked my socks off. I was just going to read a couple of things to get a flavor, and I went halfway through the book before I stopped the first time.
Wow.
She has a second book called The Terrible. I read, like, the beginning sample of that, and I have to have the book. It's just fabulous. I mean, just the opening was fabulous. Mm-hmm. A writer, Florence Welch, said, Irsa's work is like holding the truth in your hands. And she's a mixed-race poet. Her father was Jamaican, her mother Nigerian. And she really, I think every young black woman should read this book. And I'm not black, and I'm old, and I absolutely adore it. So I wanted to give you just a little sample of a couple of very, very short pieces of work. This first one is called Skill. I am my own father, but that wasn't always clear. I had to learn my duties fast. It wasn't easy. I got some lines on my face, I got a battle with the booze. I look prettier than I am, but there's a talent to that. Mm. And I just, I could feel, you know.
What she's, I look prettier than I am.
There's a talent to that. Yeah. So a lot of feeling underneath the pretty face there. Another one she did that's quite short of, but she says, she talks an awful lot about sexuality and just some of the things just make me hurt when I read them. It's fabulous. But this one, she says, a fine art. You may have learned from your mother or any other hunted woman, smiling at devils is a useful, learned thing. Swallowing discomfort down in spades, holding it tight in your belly, aging on the inside only, keeping it forever sexy. I just love what she does,
And you see that, you observe that in life, the women who perhaps are trying too hard, and because that social pressure is there to always be the sexy, the beautiful woman.
And what you've learned from your mother and those other hunted women who are telling you basically how to survive, I think.
Yeah.
And how painful it can be to swallow everything down. So she's fabulous.
I had a conversation with my 24-year-old who's staying here at the moment, and she said that all of her friends are angry. They're really angry. They're angry about how the guys just do exactly what they want.
Right.
How, they don't care about the girls' feelings, and how they don't try in bed. And they just carry on, the same sweet way. So I can really see how poetry that expresses that could really resonate with that age group.
Ether has a poem in the book Bones, which is a little lengthier but with short snippets. And it is the most powerful one, I thought, so far in the book. And it's about that, about how men react, to women. And I wanted to, I would have loved to read it to you, but I thought it might be, and also I thought it might make us have a little R rating or something.
Right. I mean, that's, again, one of the things that was mentioned in the Guardian article is the increase in the number of poems that involve the female sexual gaze.
Yeah.
Young women have always wanted to read poetry. Why do you think the troubadours knocked off verses for their lady loves? But I think they haven't always bought poetry because most published poetry has not been aimed at them. The great mass of love poetry over the centuries has been men looking at girls.
Yeah,
right. Even just 10 years ago, you could pick up an anthology and struggle to find poems in which women look at men. The only one I can actually think of is the Sylvia Plath one about Ted Hughes, actually. Right. Get this. At 17, Lucy Thin was crowned Foyle Young Poet of the Year for the third year in a row.
Oh, my God.
In 2008. And the poem is called In the Nude, and it describes how she and a female friend drove past a nudist resort and stopped to secretly observe. And this is a quote. An Adam, the whitened flesh exposed, turning towards the sun as it wobbled like a pale dessert we would never order.
Fantastic.
But that's an example of the female sexual gaze, which is becoming, quite rightly more more common. And she also says she was reading female poets in her spare time because we only studied one female poet at school.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Right. Mm. Right. I love it. I'm just so pleased to see this happening.
And it's great to discover all these voices, isn't it?
Do you think it's almost like a new phase, like in the 70s where feminism came through with the books that were, hard-hitting and angry and truthful?
Yes,
truthful. Perhaps women are now feeling completely disenfranchised again,
Yeah, I think that may well be true, but there's also this thing that social media is unmediated. You don't need an agent. Yeah. You don't need a publisher. That's need a book.
Anybody can just publish anything.
And actually some very, very talented and inspiring writers are out there doing exactly that. And I think, Stephanie, you were quite interested in Helen Mort.
Yes, I was. Helen Mort was born in Sheffield in 1985, and she's actually an alumna of Christ College, Cambridge. So she's not your kind of classic urban poet, and she has a PhD, which she did at Sheffield, a thesis in English neuroscience. But during that time, she had a blogspot called Poetry on the Brain, which was one of Picador's best poetry blog choices. So really, that's how she came to it. She's had a couple of books of poetry published. She also writes creative nonfiction, so narrative nonfiction, as we discussed it a few weeks ago. And she's edited an anthology of poems for children. She's worked with Stuart McConey to edit One for the Road, which is Pubs and Poetry. She's perhaps more mainstream than some of the young poets, but she was fined 5 times winner of the Foyle Young Poets of the Year competition. She's been shortlisted for the Costa Prize and the T.S. Eliot, and she is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. One of the things that I was really interested about was, do you remember Alison Hargreaves, the young mother who was killed climbing K2? Helen Mort has written several poems to Alison. She's obviously been inspired by Alison's determination to do what she wanted to do. And I just had to go and buy the book. You can actually watch her film poem, Dear Alison, online. Sure, we can put the link up.
Put the link up, definitely.
You know, Carol Ann Duffy described Helen Mort as among the brightest stars in the sparkling new constellation of young British poets. Mark Haddon describes her short story collection as addictively sinister. And the book apparently is about relationships in a dystopian future Britain. And she's got her first novel out this year, which is called Black Car Burning. So she's actually come from, you know, one place and sort of painting her name in the sky now. I've read an interview that she did with Grunter magazine with Rachel Allen. What Helen Mort says, I think poets are often people who are obsessed with connecting things. It's almost superstitious, that kind of noticing. I often wish I saw the world as somewhere less interconnected, really. She's maybe not the underprivileged, disadvantaged. Yeah, right. She's had some advantages, but certainly making her way in the world.
But I mean, it's about everybody having a voice, and that doesn't mean that because you've had, perhaps a more conventional, traditional education, you shouldn't be allowed to have a voice, is it?
Right,
but it's just
that
it's opening up now to people from diverse backgrounds, which is brilliant.
This is a poem she wrote called Kiss, which was after she read that a few weeks after her first rock climb, Alison kissed a boy for the first time. And in the book by Ed Douglas and David Rose, which was about Alison Hargreaves, they said, unlike her climbing, the event was recorded in her diary without detail or comment. So Alison Hargreaves' diary is a young woman. She went into a lot of detail about her rock climb and then said, oh, I kissed a boy yesterday. And this is the poem that Helen Mort wrote in response to reading that. But why record that unexpected warmth? Your lips as vague as his face becoming yours. The way you noticed every tooth inside his mouth. How could you write that you weren't sure whether to close your eyes, and when you did, you felt suspended in thin air? It came to this. Your hot, overfamiliar breath, the taste of his stale chewing gum, and your hands clamped to your sides, and you, for the first time, not knowing what to do with them. I just think that's a lovely twist on a first kiss. That's when you lost agency that you have when you're climbing a rock.
And also there's something quite subversive about the idea that actually the climbing was much more important to her, more detail in her diary than what is supposed to be the most important event in your life, which is boy meets girl. Perfect. You know. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. That's a short one that's got some great books.
Great. Well, when I do the links, I will put the names of some other of these young up-and-coming poets and links, if I can find them, to their work, because it's opened up a whole new world of poetry to me.
So, and to me, and I think you said that the average reader was 18 to 34. Was that right?
I think I said that poetry sales, in one of these articles, it says...
Yeah.
Young women aged 13 to 24.
13 to 24.
Are the biggest consumers, which is pretty astonishing.
Yes,
and presumably they will continue consuming poetry in their life. I would hope so.
Yeah.
But
I'd like to say that I am well beyond 24 years. And I think that what got me just reading this one young poet was I could so identify with all the things she was saying. So from my youth, you know, and so it isn't, I don't think we should limit the appeal. People, if you're older, go out and buy these books. They're wonderful.
But I think what Teresa said, the fact that anyone now can publish anything on Instagram, and the fact that these people are all familiar with Instagram and Twitter and all the other media has meant that they have found a route to their audience that's completely bypassed agents and publishers and the printed books and so on.
Yeah,
you know, and good luck to them, I say.
Yeah,
good luck
brilliant.
To them.
But I think the point that Linda's making is an important one. There's something for everyone to enjoy, to find, to recognise in these poems. It's not limited to any gender or age group. It's just as a phenomenon of something that's happening. It's fascinating. And young men are buying poetry as well. That is increasing, just not quite so impressively.
Uh-huh. Are they buying the female poets or not?
Now that I do not know.
I wonder. Because I thought, if they're buying the female poets, they could learn what they're doing wrong.
And maybe that's why. Maybe they want a little bit of insight.
And when you first started talking about this, I didn't really relate to it at all. But thinking about it, because I follow a lot of my daughter's friends on, there's one young lady called Amy Lindsdale, and I'll give you the link to her Instagram account. She routinely just publishes poems just on a, you know, a white background with an old-fashioned typeface.
Yes.
And I hadn't really registered that they were poems.
Yes.
So I think the stigma about reading poetry perhaps has been completely bypassed. Not stigma, you know, the
anxiety.
I don't understand poems. I don't know.
Yeah.
So perhaps the young people are reading these things from people like Amy and thinking, oh, that's fantastic, I'll resonate with that, I'll share it.
Yeah.
They're not even thinking necessarily it's
clicking
poetry.
That it's a poem. Yeah. And poetry is being used in advertising a lot on TV. We're seeing it a lot these days.
Spoken word people on building society ads and all sorts.
But that point about accessibility and anxiety, because it's something, if you don't mind me quoting you, Stephanie, but I think you have a bit of an anxiety around poetry because you think, I don't have the technical language to discuss it or understand it. You don't need a technical language, you know. Just read it. If you like it, that's okay. If you don't like it, that's okay.
Does it make you feel something?
Yes. Yeah. What do these words do to you?
And iambic pentameter be damned with these.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a great quote. Yeah.
Is that the dumpty-dumpty-dumpty?
Yeah.
You don't need to know what an iambic pentameter is or any other technical stuff to read and enjoy poetry.
You don't have to have every third line rhyme with the first one or something. It's totally open and free and honest.
Yeah.
It's great.
So, shall we hear the interview with Amy Lee Tempest? It was really, really good, wasn't it, Stephanie? We really enjoyed talking to her. Yeah. And I'll share the link to her 50-minute-long poetry sequence that is on the SoundCloud that she did for her dissertation, because it's really well worth a listen.
And a really different way to disseminate poetry, isn't
Absolutely.
It, on SoundCloud? Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah.
All bets are off.
Yeah.
It's whatever you want.
We're delighted to welcome Amy Lee Tempest to the podcast. Amy is a recently graduated performance poet from Burnley in the north of England. Hello, Amy.
Hi.
Tell us a little about your journey as a writer.
It's a very recent start, actually. It's only been a couple of years that I've actually been writing. It was something that, when I was a kid, I always thought I was going to be a writer. I told everybody I was going to be a writer. I had a typewriter and everything in my bedroom that I got for Christmas. But when I sat down to actually write, I didn't think I was very good. I didn't, and it was just sort of like I was basically just ripping off Disney films that I was watching at the time and just writing stories about cats. But it always stuck with me that it was something I wanted to try and do. But life just took me on a different path. I just ended up getting into care work, being a counsellor. And it was when I became unwell and I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So I wasn't able to work in a care home setting. that I sort of sat down and thought, what do I really want to do for me? What would be a good thing to give myself that I can enjoy? And the answer to that was going to university and doing literature and creative writing. And that was at age 28, I think it was, 28 to 29 when I started. So before that point, I wasn't really writing. I might have been jotting things down, thoughts that I were having on envelopes and things, but I wasn't actively trying to write a story or writing a poem or anything like that. It was just something that I always felt I wanted to try and do, something that I thought would be good for me.
And so is it through that creative writing part of your degree that you came to poetry as your preferred mode of expression?
Poetry was something that I did like to read occasionally before that. I had been to a few poetry gigs, open mics locally. I'd seen some local poets. It was something I'd wanted to try but hadn't. It was through sort of reading poetry in literature and getting to understand what poetry is about in a technical way and how much can be done with poetry that I tried it for my creative writing projects. And because I was getting some quite good marks on doing that, I just thought, well, just keep doing it to just sort of get those marks in. And then from there, now I don't have a reason to write to a deadline or to try and get marks or anything like that. You know, I thought, do I even still want to do it? And I have. I've still been writing little bits here and there. I've still got plans for other things to do. So it's something that happened quite naturally, really. I just found it to be, I felt a bit overwhelmed by some of the ways of teaching at university, having to, for instance, I can't spell, I'm not good at grammar. Having to think about the technicality of writing, I found quite overwhelming sometimes. For me, writing poetry meant I could do it quite quickly without thinking about that stuff. It just happened very fast. I didn't have to think about how I was doing it. I just knew I was doing something, I was writing something. And it just sort of just felt quite natural to do and enjoyed it.
Well, that brings up a couple of things, really. One, you know, the actual, if you're not comfortable with spelling and grammar, perhaps that's why you're a performance poet more than a word poet. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I mean, I love writing short stories. I really love that. And, you know, that's something that I probably do a little bit more than poetry. Poetry just feels more natural me to do. I am doing that in my own voice, so I'm not having to create a character. I'm not having to think about what's going to happen in a narrative. It just feels like I am thinking aloud or speaking aloud, whether it's to myself whilst I'm writing, sort of get my thoughts straight or capture a moment that has, you know, made an impact on me. But I suppose I like the idea of it being a conversation when I am reading to other people. Sort of like I am giving something. I'm giving one side of a conversation. And I sort of assume that people listening and having their own thoughts mean that they are filling in their replies in a way. It just feels natural, like I'm not having to work too hard at it. I just see it as a really quick, instant way of connecting with people.
Well, I listened to your poetry sequence on the SoundCloud. And yeah, it does feel very natural in the way that you use speech rhythms and pauses, leaving gaps for the listener. Yeah, interact with it. You know, I really, really like that. But given that you say it's almost instant, does that mean you don't revise or edit what you do?
I try to keep that to a minimum. Mostly it's going off my own feeling. I've once something's down on paper, and I've got whatever it is that has made an impression in my mind out on paper. I see that as done. I'm almost bored of it once it's done. So I don't want to read it again. I don't want to see it again. And I don't want to think about it again. So editing doesn't, it feels like something I want to keep to a minimum. But also for the reasons of I want to try and be as honest, authentic and as direct as possible. So that it has come from me. I suppose that's to do with the connection and the conversation kind of things that I'm going for, but also just because I find editing boring and I don't want to do it. How I would do it is I'd get whatever it is I'm trying to do down on paper, and my process then is just reading it aloud. And each time I read it aloud, I will be thinking about the rhythms, how it feels coming out of my mouth, if something feels clunky, if I feel like I need to breathe, but I've put too long a sentence there or too many words, or if the words I'm stumbling over them because I've tried to be too clever, I'll take them out. And I just do that a few times. So it's usually not adding things, taking things out that I think aren't needed. Yeah, it's usually cutting down rather than adding. I might move things around a little bit. I do things on a laptop, so it's really easy to just cut and paste and just move things around. But mostly I just go off how it feels intuitively to read it aloud. And if I enjoy reading it, then it stays. If it doesn't, I'll cut it out. And it's pretty much that.
How long has the idea been going around your head before putting it on paper?
Probably a few days. So it might be, what often happens is maybe it's something that's happened in my life or in the day, and it's made me feel a little bit uneasy. Or it's just made that kind of uneasy feeling where I think, I'm not quite done with that moment that's happened. You know, I want to reflect on that moment a little bit more. It's made me feel uneasy and I want to figure out why, kind of thing. But also a way of just getting it out of my head. But sometimes it's just a moment struck me as interesting and I want to document that, or I want to see how that comes out. So normally it'll be in my head for about 2-3 days. It might be just a line. I'll keep thinking of a certain line. It might be a feeling I want to capture or an image that I keep remembering, you know, like I've seen something somewhere and I want to try and remember that image. And I'll think about it for a few days. After a few days, it's annoyed me so much that I'll just write it. A lot of times, though, I don't, and then it's lost. So it's trying to catch it whilst it's there before it goes, I think. So usually that's within a couple of days. If I manage to find the time to sit down and write, I'll try and, do it within a few days of whatever's happened.
Would it be fair to say that you're not really a technical kind of poet? You don't really adhere to the poetic conventions or classic style of writing?
Yeah, not consciously. I'm not aiming to, and I don't think I do. I like the feeling of freedom and rule breaking that poetry is for me. I think a lot of it is down to when I mentioned being at doing creative writing at university level. Feeling like maybe I wasn't very clever, technical, or it hurt my brain to think about. And the way I could get around that was to work from a different place and be more intuitive about it, and to just not think too much whilst doing it. Because if I thought about it, it's great to do literature and creative writing together, but when you're learning about, say, Keats and Blake, and then you go and try and write your own poem, it's like, oh my God, I can't do what they do, what the greats do. So it can be quite overwhelming. So it was just about trying to find a way that I was comfortable doing it. And that meant not thinking too much about what I was doing. I just tried to have the aim of, you are trying to capture a moment is what I try and do. And it's trying to keep it as close to whatever I'm feeling or whatever I've seen. Try and keep it as close to that as possible. So I'm sure, like, if you look at my poetry, you know, there will be techniques in there, but I'm not aware of it at the time. I could spot it afterwards, but at the time I'm not really thinking along those lines.
According to a recent survey, sales of poetry in the UK increased by 12% last year, with teenage girls and young women making up the majority of consumers. Do you have any thoughts about what's going on in the world of poetry and young women?
I love what's going on. There just seems to be a lot of poetry around just generally. You know, that might just be because I'm looking for it now, but I don't think there's ever been a poetry night in my hometown in Burnley before that I know of or that anybody I know knows of. But there is one that happens once a month here, and it gets busy. It's got a really good vibe to it. It feels really current and exciting. I like the idea that it's appealing to women, and particularly young women, more, because that kind of, you know, as a woman myself, I'm only 33, so not that young, but youngish. It feels good that I can say, go on Instagram and quickly read a poem. I'm not paying for it. Someone's put it out there for me. I can do it really fast. You know, it takes me a minute to just read that poem. I can get on whilst, you know, with whatever else I'm doing, if I'm washing up and cooking, and I've just, you know, interacted with someone's thoughts, feelings that I don't know from anywhere in the world. I just think it's really accessible. And I think it's quite funk, actually, because it gets rid of, it bypasses that having to submit yourself to a publisher, which I'm going to guess is probably male dominated, as most things are. But, you know, when it gets to the top levels, the decision making levels of who gets published. So I like the idea that young women are taking it into their own hands, and it bypasses all that, and it power, consumer power, to the people who, you know, on Instagram, whether they decide to click buy or not, that is their choice. There's no advertising that's going into it. So I like that. I think it's a really good move. I hope it continues.
We're talking about Instagram and Twitter and talking about poetry nights in your hometown. Sounds a little bit about, we're talking about using poetry as a way in creating communities.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I got into poetry and wanted to try performing it as well, you know, on top of writing it, was because I'd been to open mics. I'd felt a good community bond there. I had a good experience. I've been to these places on my own, and that's been okay. There's nowhere else I can think of where I'd walk in there on my own and feel so comfortable. There just seems to be a very good atmosphere and vibe around those kind of places. It feels exciting as well. It's something that's so separate from your everyday life, I think, because you can be walking around Burnley Town Centre and having surface level friendly conversations with people all day, but then you can step to a little room above a pub and hear people's darkest, most intimate thoughts and secrets and their anger about politics or whatever it is that they've been thinking about that the night before when they scribbled all this down. So I think it's really special, and I don't know many places in community that allow us to be that honest without judgment, to have that freedom to express yourself and be applauded for it. You know, it's nice to do that and be applauded. And it doesn't matter what people sort of, if I'm reading a poem to an audience, I assume that people will be judging. I know that I am being vulnerable by speaking so openly about myself, my thoughts, my feelings, my family history. I am in a vulnerable situation, and I really get a buzz from that. And I think people who do it must get a buzz from that, of you are opening yourself up to judgment and criticism, but you are being treated with kindness and openness and being applauded for it. And I can't think of anywhere else that does that. I love music, I love going to gigs, but it's a different thing entirely. It doesn't feel as such a strong connection to our humanity as what Poetry Nights I'm doing.
I noticed you using colour as sort of a reference. Yeah. And a lot of poetry uses colour, and I wondered if that was a deliberate thing, or if you think in colours.
Well, I find that interesting, because I can't honestly think of a single poem where I've used colour, so that's how not aware of doing it I am. So
you said orange made you thirsty.
Thinking about it, yeah, I think there might be two explanations for that. I think one is because I will have been trying to capture an image from memory. So I would want to be trying to get it into the reader's brains, what I'm seeing, to have caused what I'm feeling, or, you know, I suppose it's setting the scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I'm not aware of it. It's not something that I'm aware of. I can only think that I must be doing it as, you know, like an impressionistic kind of thing, and images, maybe I'm working in images, because I can still, I know which poem you're talking about now, about the sun. And that was about being on a bus and seeing the sunset. It was a gorgeous sunset. I was just coming home from work, and it was just simply that, and feel, and what that made me feel. And it's just one of those images that stuck with me, and I can still picture it now. So I think maybe I'm just trying to share it, and the best way to do that is to describe it as exactly possible. I think there's a lot of power in that, because it's a universally understood language in a way, colour, you know, why paintings work for us, regardless of speaking different languages, and just the way that images work. We can all agree that a dark blue is probably going to make us feel, all of us humans are going to feel a certain way and have certain connotations about that. So it's really kind of easy and accessible, I suppose, writing tool that writers will always fall back on and lean back on, because it works, and we do work in images, and we are surrounded by those images. And I think you're trying to put that image in some stranger's head and let them try and attach what you're saying about it. they can, you know, adding that colour will help them work from that, I suppose. But I had no idea I was doing that. I suppose I'm just describing something I've seen and that just came out that way.
What are you working on at the moment, Amy?
Nothing actively. I wrote a short story a couple of days ago, which I really loved. It was just one of those moments where, like I said, I'd been to an event, something had happened, it had created an uneasy feeling in me. That stuck with me for a few days. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to get rid of it. So I wrote a short story. I really enjoyed doing that. I'm not really sort of pushing it. I'm not sort of supporting publishers or anything like that. I'm more enjoying, I do writing workshops and writing groups in the area. So I'm going to be working with a local hospice soon, working with cancer patients there and doing some uplifting poetry writing, hopefully. And I'm also hopefully having an exhibition at Burnley Library. So my dissertation wallpaper, which is the one you heard on SoundCloud, I'm hopefully getting it printed on actual wallpaper and hanging that from the ceiling and doing a reading there as well as part of something called Opening in Burnley and the Burnley Literary Festival. So I'm just crossing my fingers that works, because I'm going to be just figuring out how I hang 46 sheets of wallpaper from the ceiling with just some string and a glue gun.
You are quite busy.
Yeah.
And that wallpaper, the audio version, would you like to share that?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. So it'd be lovely if people did want to listen to that. And I'd love to get some feedback on it if people had any thoughts. And just see how people react to it. Because, like I said, I do think poetry is about a conversation. And I don't think it has to be just good feedback. I think, you know, if it disturbs somebody or scares somebody or makes them feel a certain way, I think that's interesting feedback as well. And just finding out what people think. So it's called When the Light Comes In. We leave the club that used to be a restaurant where I had my first day at age 15. Now a sanctuary for the goths, the grungers, the scene kids in skinny jeans and band tees and the androgynous youth. The occasional cross-dresser, the misfits, the broken biscuits, the ones with fire in their spirits, seeking shelter from girls in stilettos and skin-headed men with stares that threaten smaller jaws. Me, in a fur coat and peacock feathers. You, with a tight t-shirt and trench coat, huddle under shop doorways until drips make us damp. With wet hands, we wave down the taxi. You say, if there was a trophy for the least practical coat, I would win. And you would win a trophy for the first man I'd ever seen clubbing in waterproof clothes. We argue on the journey through terrace streets and closed down crumbling pubs about whose house we would go to drink. We never once considered separating, because drinking alone would make us drunk. The neon night behind us fades, fast becoming a wood-burning stove and cross-stitched pictures hanging from four stone walls. A 70s record player stands where any other person would position a television. A Morello cherry sofa with a charmingly odd armchair. Old cameras placed in every spare space, all unchanged last time I'd been there 4 or 5 years ago. I ask for Nancy Sinatra with that guy who's like an American Serge Gainsbourg. What's his name again? But you don't know. You thumb fast through vinyl until you find Johnny Cash and June Carter live at Folsom Prison and say the best duets are born from love. Just listen. You'll hear it in their voices. I take off the fur and with a flick of each foot, flat shoes fall on the cold stone floor. I lie back and send cigarette smoke circling up to the ceiling. You rolled up in delicate skins and say something about Nina Simone. But I don't know. What about Nancy? It's an incomplete night without a tone. We agree on Edith Piaf and sing Padam, 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 out of tune and time, but we sing it together. Did you know she was called the Little Swallow? It's so sad. I remember her graveside in Paris. Didn't you know about that? but you leave for the kitchen cupboard, returning to present a bottle of Benedictine brought back from France along with photos of the flamboyant palais taken for your next exhibition. Shot, you tell me, with Leica M6, Rolleiflex 3.5F and Contax T2. Like it will make me love them more. It will. Careful, you don't film on the prints. Careful. They make me want to taste Paris again, so you stir Benny and Hot in cracked cups and speak of the Burnley miners using the monk's elixir as medicine and in London's opium dens too. And now me and you, Adium, cheers. We drink to the monks, miners and artists, all touched by this, feet hit on the throw, 27 spices and herbs blended with the magic of an alchemist in Normandy centuries ago. Upstairs, I step out of tights at the side of the bed. You trace the outline of flowers on my thigh with your eyes and ask, when did you get that? A lot of time has passed. Under sheets, to the sound of Radio 6, we kiss, missing each other's lips in the dark, catching chins, cheeks and teeth. We've had far too much benefit this, let's sleep. We have tomorrow and the days after that too. So I stroke your curls, shocked by their thinning until sleep strangles at your throat. This is why we never worked before. You snore, and sleep only seduces me in silent rooms. Daylight taps at the windows to take the night that we belong to, breaks through glass in dirty streams and shows dust on the windowsill, the sheets and the side lamp, and you, like a fallen Donatella statue, you're half ruined. I search through twisted sheets for something lost, hoping to sneak away before time makes dust of us. And that's how the new year comes in. Suddenly, sobering, and grabs at my throat with her cup.
Wow, that was something else.
It was, yeah. Excellent, thank you very much.
That's brilliant.
It's been wonderful to talk to you, Amy, and you know,
thank you.
Open and fresh and honest, and that's been really great.
Clearly very talented.
Yeah, absolutely. So
thank you. I've loved that.
Well, now that I've read this one and listened to her, I'm definitely going to pick up one of her books and read it. And I saw a picture of her online, and she's gorgeous.
Well, there you go.
And Iser is gorgeous also. In fact, she worked as a model and an actress. And I think, you girls are so pretty, and you're not, I mean, when she's writing about it, she's like, sometimes beauty is a burden. You know, yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And of course, you can find all these people just by going to Instagram and typing in the search bar, Poets of Instagram.
Yes. Which is, yeah, fantastic stuff. And we love talking to Amy and hope we'll get to talk to her again sometime because she's just great. So it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Heather and John Lomas Bullivant to share their reading with us. Heather, what's on your bedside table?
Well, during our summer break, I had a trip to the Isle of Wight. And as you may have picked up, my surname is Worsley. And we found lots and lots of Worsleys on the Isle of Wight.
Oh, interesting.
That I didn't know about at all. The Scandalous Lady W, written by Hallie Rubenhold. True story of what happened. And it is fascinating. It was the divorce that scandalised George in England. She was a spirited young heiress. He was a handsome baronet with a promising career in government. Their marriage had the makings of a fairy tale, but ended as one of the most salacious and highly publicised divorces in history. For over 200 years, the story of Lady Worsley and her vengeful husband and her lover, George Maurice Bissett, lay buried in long-forgotten newspapers, overlooked pamphlets and yellowing satires. No other author, past or present, has told it before. Now, Hallie Rubenhold, in her impeccably researched book, brings the three protagonists back to life and presents a rarely seen picture of aristocratic life in the Georgian era.
Sounds great.
Well, if that hasn't got my name on it, that is just the sort of thing I love reading.
There, it's on my Kindle, ready.
That sounds brilliant.
Make myself comfortable and start to read. And I didn't know there were so many Worsleys about and that they were so famous.
Interesting.
Infamous, I think.
Infamous is the word. Okay, let's hear from John.
John Lomas Bullivant, what's on your bedside table?
It's a book called The Earth is Weeping. It's by a guy called Peter Cousins, and it's the story of the Indian Wars of the American West. So as a man of a certain age, I grew up on cowboys and Indian films and always used to have a sneaking sympathy for the Indians, Native Americans, as we now call them. So I saw this and I just thought, okay, I'd love to know what the complete history was of how essentially they were ethnically cleansed, wiped off the face of the earth, and nobody ever gets to talk about it, really. It's really sort of intriguing as to how the Americans post the Civil War were kind of endlessly making treaties with the Indians, but at the same time shipping wagon loads of people ever west. And so the Indians were ever going, hang on, I thought this was our land. And then people were either coming and settling on it or passing through and generally trashing any treaty that the Americans sort of set up. But the other thing I hadn't appreciated was part of their downfall was how much the tribes absolutely hated each other. The Comanches would hate the Cheyenne or the Blackfeet. They would hate them more than they would the white men. And they spent so long almost like fighting with each other, refusing to sort of acknowledge any kind of collaboration or cooperation, that actually that was as much their downfall as not having rifles. And it's just intriguing as to a part of American history, which I don't think gets talked about very much. Understandably, American history is, a lot of it talks about slavery and, you know, how appalling that was. But no one really wants to go back to the bit beforehand and go, do you know what? This was the biggest act of ethnic cleansing that has gone on in an awfully long time. And it wasn't that long ago. It was only, I mean, you're talking about sort of the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. Which is, you know, it's like 30 years before World War One, and we're busy celebrating sort of 100 years of sort of like World War One, and you go back 130 years ago. Well, no one's talking about the fact that this was when basically the equivalent of the last of the Mohicans was just wiped off the face of North America, and the white man from Europe took over. And I'm waiting for the Americans to sort of own that bit of their history.
Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening, especially if you're in Rochdale in the UK, where we seem to have had a few listens recently. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a 5-star review, or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Keep sharing the love by introducing a friend to Write Club the podcast. Goodbye!
Bye!
Goodbye!